rule the empire by force. What of Portugal's Southeast Asian Maritime Empire? And what was the Second Burmese Empire? After 3 years of missionary work in India, in 1545, Francis Xavier left the subcontinent and sailed to Malacca. Here, he spent a few months ministering in this most important of Portugal's Southeast Asian holdings, then sailed on to the Moluccas, the Spice Islands of modern-day Indonesia, specifically Ambon, Ternate, Morotai, and nearby islands, where the Portuguese had established a number of small settlements. In the islands, he preached the gospel and baptized converts, then returned to Malacca. When the Aceh Sultanate, based on the island of Sumatra, attacked Malacca in 1546, Xavier was there to watch as, according to Portuguese accounts, an Achenese fleet of around 60 vessels, carrying perhaps 5,000 men, including 80 Ottoman mercenaries and Janissary defectors, approached the Portuguese-controlled port city. Aceh had tried to take Malacca 8 years earlier, 1537, but had been repelled. Now the Aceh fleet's initial attack also failed, and it withdrew north to the Perlis River. At first, the Portuguese were hesitant to pursue this sizable enemy force, but in a passionate plea, Francis Xavier admonished the governor and his soldiers to take the offensive, despite being significantly outnumbered. Later, Jesuit tradition would attribute Xavier with having received a vision of Aceh's defeat. Encouraged by the Jesuits' preaching, a small Portuguese flotilla, 9 light galleys and around 230 men, tracked the Aceh pirates to the Perlis, where a subsequent clash saw the Portuguese destroy or capture virtually all of Aceh's assembled ships. Since Portugal's 1511 seizure of Malacca, the maritime empire's control of trade routes and choke points had only increased. Portuguese explorers reached Timor a year or two after Malacca, followed quickly by Dominican missionaries. In the 1540s, Portuguese merchants established a presence in the Macassar area, on the island of Sulawesi. It later grew into a thriving commercial center. In 1566, another group of Dominicans established a fort on the island of Solor, both to proselytize to the locals and to ensure Portuguese control of the lucrative sandalwood trade. 2 years later, the Portuguese erected another fortress on Ambon to secure the trade routes in and out of the Spice Islands, and to protect the eastern approach to Malacca. In 1604, the Portuguese built another fortress some 25 miles down the coast at Muar. Thus, instead of large land conquests, the Portuguese imperial policy focused on maintaining naval superiority and establishing a monopoly over trade routes via a network of ships, forts, and ports. While Southeast Asia itself offered much in the way of trade goods, the Portuguese used their bases here to expand their reach into China and Japan too. But the fortunes of Portugal's maritime empire began to shift after 1580, the year of the Iberian Union. After a brief military campaign, Philip II of Spain had united Portugal and Spain under a single crown, his own. This was a personal union rather than a true merger, meaning both Spain and Portugal would retain their own separate administrations and governments, even as they shared the same sovereign. However, the foreign policy of both states now more or less aligned, according to the wishes of the shared monarch. In practice, this meant that Madrid dominated Portugal's foreign affairs. As we'll see, the Iberian Union would last 60 years, dissolving in 1640. For the Portuguese, this also meant that all of Spain's many enemies were now enemies of Portugal. So when ships of the Dutch East India Company and English East India Company, both virulently anti-Spanish, first sailed into Southeast Asian waters in the early years of the 17th century, the Portuguese monopoly almost immediately began to unravel. No less than 14 separate Dutch fleets penetrated the region in the 1590s and early 1600s, their return cargoes netting them immense profits. In 1605, the Dutch took Ambon, the inaugural voyage of the Joint Stock English East India Company, led by Sir James Lancaster aboard the Red Dragon, reached the Strait of Malacca in 1602, where the English proceeded to capture a Portuguese ship before establishing factories, that is, trading posts, on Java and in the Moluccas. The English merchant fleet returned to England the next year, laden with pepper. At the same time, the English were capturing Portuguese shipping in Southeast Asia. The various merchant fleets and trading ventures of the Netherlands were organizing under the banner of the Vereenigde Oostindische Compagnie, VOC, which by 1619 had founded its central base at Batavia, now called Jakarta, on Java, soon to be the company's main trade hub in Asia. Thus, by around 1620, under intense pressure from its new competitors, Portuguese control of regional trade routes had been broken, and the once cohesive Portuguese maritime empire would soon be reduced to a handful of struggling trading posts, as we'll see. Even as the maritime competition between European would-be monopolists was picking up steam in Southeast Asian waters, on the mainland, the Tungku dynasty under Tabanchweti was building the largest empire the region had ever seen. After toppling Hanthawaddy, capturing Pegu and making it his new capital, and subduing the Mon, thanks in part to musket-wielding Portuguese mercenaries, Tabanchweti turned north to face the mighty confederation of Shan states. In 1542, at the head of an 8,000-man land army, supported by a 9,000-man, 1,400-vessel naval force, the latter made up largely of Mon fighters, he captured Shan-controlled Prome, west of the original Tungku heartland. The fall of Prome meant that Tabanchweti now also securely controlled Burma's great medieval capital, Pagan, where in 1544, the Tungku dynast was crowned with all the pomp and ritual of the old pagan kings. A second coronation took place in Hanthawaddy the next year, where Tabanchweti was crowned, according to Mon ritual. In 1546, Tabanchweti continued his string of conquests by invading and conquering southern stretches of Arakan along Burma's northwestern coast. In the midst of the Arakan invasion, Tabanchweti received news that the Kingdom of Siam had taken the coastal city of Tavoy, a city claimed by the Tungku. Tabanchweti now abandoned the rest of his Arakan plans and redirected his military efforts toward Tavoy. Thus began a 2-year war between the rising Tungku Empire and mighty Siam, a tussle that would initiate a long series of Burmese-Siamese wars grinding on, with brief intermissions, for a century. By late 1547, Tungku forces had retaken Tavoy, but Tabanchweti had grander ambitions and now planned for a full-scale invasion of Siam, with an eye toward the capture of wealthy Ayutthaya itself. In 1548, a 12,000-man Tungku army, led personally by Tabanchweti and his childhood friend Bayanaung, marched through Three Pagodas Pass in the Tenasserim Hills. Breaking through Siamese border defenses, the Burmese force made its way straight to Ayutthaya. After a 1-month siege of the great capital, however, the Siamese managed to push the Burmese back. Even in retreat, the latter tried to take Kamphaeng Phet, a Siamese provincial capital, but the city's Portuguese mercenary defenders helped repel them. By early 1549, the Tungku army had retreated all the way back to Tungku territory. Siam had survived this first Burmese onslaught. Soon after returning from his Siam campaign, Tabanchweti seems to have developed an overwhelming thirst for wine, especially the strong stuff concocted by a young Portuguese mercenary in his employ. Thereafter, Tabanchweti was far more interested in hunting and drinking, and, if the widespread rumors were true, bedding other men's wives, then in planning campaigns or administering the state. These latter responsibilities he now handed off to his friend, Bainaung. When a rebellion against the drunk king's rule broke out around 1549, Taban Shweti dispatched Bainaung to suppress it, while the king departed on yet another hunting and drinking expedition. While pursuing a rare white elephant, one of Taban Shweti's own Mon governors arranged for his assassination. Two of the governor's swordsmen subsequently beheaded the king in his own tent. Almost immediately after the killing of Taban Shweti, and despite the fact that Bainaung had been Taban Shweti's chosen successor, virtually every governor in the realm declared himself the rightful heir to the throne. Thus it was that Bainaung, a king without a kingdom, spent the next several years defeating his various challengers and otherwise repairing the fragmented state left to him by the murdered Taban Shweti. Central Burma fell to Bainaung in 1551, including Prome and Pagan. The next year he secured Lower Burma, and the year after that, much of Upper Burma. In his capital at Pegu, Bainaung was formally crowned king in 1554. But like his pre-alcoholic predecessor, Bainaung had greater territorial ambitions than these. Just months after his coronation, Bainaung assembled an 18,000-man army, including Portuguese mercenaries and Portuguese-supplied firepower, supplemented by almost 1,000 horses, 80 war elephants, and a riverine naval force, and conquered the Upper Burman rump state of Ava. By 1555, Bainaung controlled both the Irrawaddy and Sitong river valleys. He now determined to finally subdue the surrounding Shan states, whose raids had been a constant threat for decades. In 1556, then, Bainaung assembled one of the largest armies ever seen in the region, 36,000 men, and invaded Shan country. In the face of such overwhelming numbers, some of the Shan states surrendered without much of a fight. Others resisted, though Bainaung subdued these with surprising ease. Only the most outlying Shan states, vassals of Ming China, were left alone by the Burmese emperor. Bainaung next targeted the neighboring northern Thai kingdom of Lan Na, based at Chiang Mai. This city, too, surrendered without a fight, and Bainaung turned the king of Lan Na into a Tunggu vassal, albeit one guarded by 1,000-man Burmese garrison. Meanwhile, a group of Lan Na artisans were carried back to Pegu to beautify the Burmese capital. So powerful was Burma now that even the Chinese-aligned Shan states began paying tribute to Pegu. Bainaung next invaded Manipur in modern northeastern India, whose Raja surrendered in 1560, then secured Burmese control over the remaining Chinese-aligned Shan states. In 1563, Bainaung invaded Siam again. According to tradition, after the Siamese king Mahachakrapat refused to give him two of his four sacred white elephants. As we've seen, Bainaung had invaded Siam before, and he well understood that in a showdown against Ayutthaya, his Portuguese firepower would be matched by the Portuguese firepower of the Siamese. His best hope, then, was in overwhelming numbers. The Burmese armies that marched into Siam then consisted of no less than 60,000 men plus several thousand horses and almost 400 war elephants. After taking Kamphaeng Phet, the Burmese captured several other key Thai cities before marching on Ayutthaya itself, with its seemingly impenetrable fort guarded by Portuguese ships and batteries. Within weeks, the fort had fallen, and the Siamese king formally surrendered in early 1564. After appointing a vassal king, leaving a garrison of 3,000 men in Ayutthaya, and looting the capital, including all four white elephants, Bainaung returned victorious to Burma. Never before had Southeast Asia seen such a geographically extensive polity, stretching from Manipur in the northwest to Lanzhong, with its capital at Vientiane, the capital of modern Laos, in the northeast, from the Shan states in the north to the central part of the Malay Peninsula in the south. In 1568, Bainaung triumphantly entered his new palace at Pegu, declaring himself the Chakravartin, or wheel-turner. According to Indian tradition, a universal ruler figure on par with the ancient Ashoka. Bayanaung thus evoked the region's Buddhist and Hindu heritage in order to maintain his vast empire, one loosely structured through personal allegiance to him. Still, over the next 13 years, before his 1581 death, Bayanaung seemed constantly at work maintaining his conquests by force of arms, putting down an uprising here, squelching a rebellion there, reasserting political or military authority somewhere else. In 1569, the great Chakravartin was forced to invade Siam again, this time subjecting Ayutthaya to a grueling 10-month siege before taking the city, dismantling the local government completely, and installing his own puppet as king. So powerful was Bayanaung by the 1570s that he successfully intervened in faraway Ceylon in a squabble between the island's several kings. Before launching a second invasion of Arakan, he may have sent an embassy to the Mughal Emperor Akbar, possibly seeking the Shahanshah's permission for the expedition. Whether or not permission was ever granted, the invasion went ahead. Unfortunately for Bayanaung, he died before the Arakan campaign could be completed. This largest in history of all mainland Southeast Asian empires crumbled almost immediately upon the death of Bayanaung under the weight of multiple internal revolts and vassal state rebellions. King Nariswan, the Great of Siam, once a hostage in Pegu but since returned to Ayutthaya, declared his kingdom's independence in 1584. Using the latest firearms, Siamese forces subsequently repelled no less than 5 separate Burmese armies between 1584 and 1592. And, at least according to Thai tradition, in 1592, Nariswan defeated and killed the Burmese crown prince, Mingi Swa, in a one-on-one elephant duel. Siam now began encroaching on Burmese territory, establishing long-term dominance along the Tenasserim coast. But the Tunggu dynasty wasn't beaten. Bayanaung's son, Nguyen Nhan Min, managed to reassert control over a smaller Burmese state, based in Ava, around 1599, then reconquer Upper Burma and the Shan states by 1605. His son and successor, Anokpet Lun, picked up where his father had left off, reconquering Lower Burma, retaking Pegu, and securing the Gulf of Martaban by expelling all Portuguese mercenaries in the area. In a later age, the Burmese would recognize 3 men as the country's great kings. The first king, Anuratha, the 11th century founder of the original unified Kingdom of Pagan, also known as the First Burmese Empire. The second king, Bayanaung, Tunggu architect of the Second Burmese Empire, including large stretches of modern-day Thailand and Laos, part of northeastern India, and virtually all of modern-day Myanmar. As for the third king, him we have yet to meet. Did the Ming show signs of decline in the late 16th and early 17th centuries? What was the Imjin War? Re-establishing context. As you get back into the Ming Dynasty, recall the following context, established previously in this course, primarily 1.1, 2.3, and 3.4. The Ming Dynasty, 1368 to 1644, was established by the former peasant Zhu Yuanzhang, known as the Hongwu Emperor, who overthrew the Mongol-led Yuan Dynasty and initiated a Han Restoration, characterized by a return to traditional Confucian values and a centralized administration. Under the subsequent Yongle Emperor, the empire reached a peak of international projection through the massive maritime expeditions of Zheng He, whose treasure ships traveled as far as East Africa to cow foreign states into sending tribute. However, by the mid-15th century, the Ming had pivoted toward isolationism, mothballing the great fleets and focusing resources on land-based defense and the expansion of the Great Wall to deter Mongol raiders. Despite this turn inward and periodic court factionalism between scholar officials and powerful eunuchs, China experienced a massive population boom, a flourishing literary culture, and general commercial prosperity fueled by agricultural innovations. And now back to the main text. Perhaps one of the most defining attributes of the Ming era during the late 16th and early 17th centuries, rising corruption. From the Neo-Confucian scholar's point of view, crafty eunuchs held too much power at court, and sitting emperors often neglected their sacred duties, ideal conditions for graft and malfeasance. In addition, many a poorly paid bureaucrat embezzled state funds to make ends meet, while local officials, including judges and tax collectors, routinely abused their powers at the expense of competitors and the poor. But there were would-be reformers, too. One official, a Neo-Confucian philosopher named Hai Rui, earned a reputation for absolute honesty, uprightness, courage, and concern for the poor. Unsurprisingly, he also made many powerful enemies, especially when he refused to compromise on his values even at the behest of his social betters. The son of a Muslim mother and great-grandson of an Arab, Hai Rui even wrote a memorial that lambasted the emperor himself for neglect of state affairs and indulgences in Taoist ceremonies. "Every household under your reign is stripped clean," Hai Rui's memorial bluntly and brazenly insisted. For this, the scholar official was imprisoned, tortured, and condemned to death by strangulation, and only saved from execution by the timely death of the emperor. Hai Rui's work now resumed, but the forthright official was forced out once again after insisting that several powerful families and moneylenders restore lands they had unscrupulously acquired. In the late 1950s and early 1960s, Hai Rui was made the focus of several operas viewed as veiled allegories critical of Mao Zedong and his Great Leap Forward, on which more later, resulting in the killings of the playwrights and others, and contributing to the launch of the Cultural Revolution. As we'll see, Hai Rui was far from the only Confucian critic of the regime. By the middle of the Ming era, the silver tael, ounce, had emerged as the standard monetary unit in China, and the value base for large transactions, bank reserves, and tax assessments. This change largely stemmed from the massive inflow of silver, both from Japanese mines, beginning in the 1540s, and especially American silver, from mines like Potosi, beginning in the 1570s, the latter brought over by Chinese merchants trading silk and porcelain at Spanish Manila. From the 1580s, taxes previously paid in grain, cloth, or other goods must be paid in silver ingots, Spanish silver coins, or at least bank drafts denominated in taels. Small, non-tax-related transactions were still typically carried out in copper coins. The new policy dramatically increased the domestic Chinese demand for silver, at its high point, consuming perhaps a third to a half of global silver production. This would have serious economic and political consequences for the Ming future, as we'll see. At the same time, and in an attempt to buoy up support for the regime, the dynasty granted an ever-increasing proportion of the gentry tax-free status for their lands, until the tax burden had effectively shifted to China's peasantry. The results? Severe popular resentment against the gentry, combined with a major dip in revenue for the state. Indeed, the Ming government was forced to sell off emergency grain in order to make up the difference. Little could imperial policymakers know that the Ming's money troubles were just getting started. Despite these mounting crises, most of the Ming emperors of the period remained largely uninterested in government and neglectful of their duties. As Hai Rui had pointed out, the Jiajing Emperor, reigned 1521 to 1567, was more interested in elaborate and time-consuming Taoist ritual than governance, while the Wanli Emperor, reigned 1572 to 1620, frustrated at his ministers, for decades retreated to the inner palace, indulging in decadent living and refusing to meet with his officials at all. Of course, this state of affairs granted ample opportunity for the emergence of powerful factions at court. By the end of the 16th century, especially after the death of powerful Grand Secretary Zhang Juzheng, the infighting between factions had become particularly bitter. Around 1604, a group of Neo-Confucian scholar officials, inspired by Wang Yangming's philosophy of Xinshu, established the Donglin Society, accusing political rivals of corruption, moral decay, bureaucratic rigidity, and deviation from traditional Chinese ideals. They especially opposed the increasingly powerful and, according to the Donglin movement, vicious eunuch faction in the imperial palace. Emphasizing, as Wang Yangming had done, innate moral knowledge and personal moral intuition, the Donglin intelligentsia positioned themselves as the defenders of orthodox Confucian governance, even as eunuch interference accelerated in the absence of the Wanli emperor. Not surprisingly, this rivalry-riven period was marked by imprisonments, dismissals, brutal and public humiliations, and the execution of any official who might offend or otherwise oppose the dominant palace clique. Corruption, factionalism, and fiscal woes combined with constant war. Indeed, the Ming spent enormous sums fighting pirates, the Mongols, southwestern hill tribes, Tungu Burma, Japanese invasions, and finally, a Manchurian Yurchin dynasty called the Great Jin. Armed Chinese merchants and smugglers, often labeled Japanese pirates, fed up with the Ming ban on private maritime trade, often turned to piracy, in the 1550s and 1560s, consistently raiding China's southeastern coastline. Ming efforts at battling the pirates met with mixed success, until the 1567 lifting of the maritime ban worked to drastically reduce piracy in the region. In the northwest, Altan Khan's invasions exposed Ming military weakness, prompting the court to adopt a new policy toward the Mongols: appeasement and diplomacy, beginning with a 1571 peace treaty with Altan Khan, establishing regulated horse and tea trade markets. For a time, the northern border appeared stable and relatively peaceful. In the southwest, meanwhile, hill tribes long used to a significant measure of self-government bristled under Ming attempts to replace hereditary tribal leaders with imperial bureaucrats. Rebellion here in the border regions of Sichuan, Guizhou, and Huguang involved the mobilization of hundreds of thousands of Ming troops and the battle deaths of tens of thousands of local rebel fighters. In Yunnan, the surging Tungu Burmese Empire, already successful in conquering the previously Ming-facing Shan states, now occupied territories the Ming emperors considered theirs, notably in Yunnan. Ming forces clashed with the Burmese repeatedly in this rugged border area, though in the end, as we've seen, the Second Burmese Empire collapsed on its own. Most costly of all wars during this period, however, was the Imjin War with Japan, which devastated Joseon Korea. Let's head down to the Old South Gate in Seoul, Korea, to explore this further.
Around 1590, Toyotomi Hideyoshi had completed his quest of taking over Japan, for the most part. He'd taken power, centralized power around himself, created a sort of polity in Japan that really had never been created before, at least at this level. And you'll notice in history there's sort of a pattern when a country is unified for the first time, or for the first time in a long time, and by unified, of course, we mean brutally subjugated and conquered, the martial energy of that country, which up to this point has been directed at itself, is then directed outward at some foreign country. That very often happens, and in the case of Japan, that's exactly what happened. Toyotomi Hideyoshi dreamed of conquering China. That was the big prize. China was the big prize. But he felt that in order to do so, he needed passage across Korea. That was essential. So he approached the Joseon government in Korea. At this point, the Joseon had been around a couple hundred years, tight with the Chinese, as far as they had to be in order to survive the Ming Chinese government. But otherwise, they liked to do things on their own, obviously, and flex their muscles of independence when they could. Any case, Toyotomi Hideyoshi approaches the Koreans and asks for safe passage for his armies on their way to China, to conquer China, and the Joseon refused. And so Toyotomi Hideyoshi surprise attacked Korea with 160,000 troops. That's more troops than landed at Normandy on D-Day. 160,000 troops. This would have been the southern gate of Seoul when the Japanese invaded. It had been built during the time of the first Joseon King, and this was the southern gate of the city. There's a bell that rang up there at 4 a.m. to open the gates up, to announce the opening of the city. Another bell rang at something like 10 o'clock at night to announce the closing of the gate for the night. This would have been the gate. Now, the Japanese actually got into Seoul by basically getting through the walls, not through the gates. They found a floodgate or something and broke into it and were able to get into Seoul that way. But this would have been the gate. And the Japanese held Seoul for a very long time. So Japanese troops would have marched in and out of this gate for years. When the Japanese arrived in Seoul, came to the royal palaces where I am, they found them abandoned. In fact, they found the whole city abandoned. Every shop, every house, and the royal palaces themselves had been abandoned. Some of the first to go had been the royal family and their entourages and whatnot. The king had fled, and this disgusted many Koreans. They couldn't believe that their king was abandoning them, basically leaving the capital city defenseless. He basically just locked the gates and left, or ordered the gates to be locked and left. So this humiliated many Koreans, many of whom actually joined the Japanese out of disgust for their own government's behavior. Others, of course, probably joining out of fear for their lives. But in any case, this was very bad for the Korean government, and the Japanese were able to push all the way up to Pyongyang and beyond, basically taking the whole peninsula. Now, Ming China, which of course considered Korea its vassal, sent an army of about 40,000 men to relieve Korea. But the real game changer in terms of stopping the push of the Japanese invasion came in two parts. First, from the Korean people. See, the Korean people, as I mentioned before, had actually, some of them had signed on with the Japanese out of frustration with their own government. Others were just too apathetic after being abandoned by their king. But that all changed when the true stripes of the Japanese army were revealed. And the Japanese like to keep count of their dents, sort of like keeping notches on a belt. But the way they did it, their notches came in the form of ears and noses cut off the bodies of those they'd killed. So a whole pile of bloody ears and noses, that'll change the local populace pretty quick into blood enemies. Add to the guerrilla warfare of these Korean peasants and the harassment they were able to mete out on the Japanese army, add to that the Buddhist monasteries and their monk armies, their harassments against the Japanese, and the Japanese were never quite able to exert real full control on the countryside that they'd supposedly conquered in the 1590s. The other great game changer came at sea in the form of a self-taught admiral named Yi Sun Shin. Admiral Yi should probably be one of the most famous military men in world history, but he's scarcely known outside of Korea and Japan. In preparation for the Japanese invasions, I mean, he knew that the Japanese Navy would be numerically superior to that of Korea, so he had to improvise. And what he came up with was, well, he knew that the Japanese favored boarding ships. Now, they fired a lot of cannon too, but their favored method of naval attack was to board enemy ships. And so he built what we call turtle ships, possibly the world's first ironclads. Basically, what he did is he covered his ships in a metal roof that was spiked, made it very hard to board. In fact, sometimes the Koreans would cover the spikes in thatch or straw to disguise them so that boarders would impale themselves. Anyway, made it very difficult to board these turtle ships. They were very heavy, so they required many rowers. So you had 80, 100 rowers in each ship, maybe more. They also had a lot of firepower, and they came equipped with a dragon figurehead at the front. We're not quite sure what this figurehead could do, but according to the records, it could emit a poison gas. And if the wind was right, that gas could poison the air around enemy ships. It also could act supposedly as a flamethrower. You could also shoot through it. So very, very interesting innovations. And Admiral Yi was able to wreak havoc on the Japanese Navy using these turtle ships. Again, numerically very superior Japanese Navy, drastically cutting off the supply lines of the Japanese army. And of course, any invading army, particularly one that's almost 200,000 strong, supply lines, logistics, this is key. And Admiral Yi was able to devastate those supply lines. Still, the Japanese fought furiously in Korea. So even with the Ming Relief Army, even with their setbacks at sea, even with the guerrilla warfare going on, their goal at this point wasn't really to take over China anymore. Their goal was to fight their way into a position where they could exact concessions from Korea and China and make the war worth it. And they felt that they could do this. And really, they'd proven they could take over the Korean Peninsula and pose a serious threat to China. And so Toyotomi Hideyoshi, his goal at this point was, well, three things. He wanted a Ming princess as a wife. He wanted a Joseon prince and some officials as hostages. And he wanted a large slice of southern Korea. And those were, he felt that he'd made enough of a statement to exact those concessions. And so the Japanese army left and negotiations began. Well, negotiations broke down. When Toyotomi Hideyoshi did not get the concessions that he wanted and the talks ended, a second invasion was launched. He sent 140,000 more troops to Korea. And once again, the peninsula was ravaged. And once again, the Ming sent sort of a token relief force. Now, things didn't go as well for the Koreans at sea this time around because Admiral Yi had been really fired. There was some politics going on behind the scenes. He was on the wrong side, and he was removed from office for allegedly disobeying an order. But things were so bad that he was eventually restored to his place, and immediately the Korean Navy began winning. In fact, Admiral Yi never lost a naval battle. He was in almost 30, and he never lost one. So pretty incredible record. He would die before the war was out. He was shot in battle and succumbed to that wound, but not before, once again, wreaking havoc on the Japanese Navy and really turning the tide. That, combined with the death of Toyotomi Hideyoshi, convinced the Japanese to turn around and go home. Two invasions over 7 years, possibly the most destructive war in Korean history, including the Korean War of the 20th century. Not just the Japanese, but the Chinese army had devastated the peninsula. Both had ravaged the peninsula multiple times. There was massive loss of human life, not just from, you know, the fighting, but the destruction of farms and homes had led to famine, which led to disease on a catastrophic scale. And this was seriously devastating. The royal palace in Seoul had been mostly burned to the ground. Temples had been destroyed, homes, records. In fact, tens of thousands of books were burned during this period. Histories were burned. This is irreplaceable stuff. And this was really, really devastating. The Joseon was never as strong afterwards. The Japan-Korea animosity that runs strong into the present can be traced back to this event. But the war had a wider impact. The Imjin War had weakened the Toyotomi clan back in Japan, paving the way for the dominance of the Tokugawa, with all of its implications for the next 250 years of Japanese history. Meanwhile, the Japanese army, which had destroyed the Ming garrisons in northern Korea, left that power vacuum to be filled by the Manchus in that area. Of course, a few decades later, the Manchus would go on to conquer China and bring down the Ming themselves and conquer China and rule it into the 20th century. So these are some major consequences of the Imjin War. And unfortunately for the Koreans, the Japanese weren't quite done at trying to conquer and rule the Korean Peninsula. But that's a 20th century story.
Together, these many campaigns, though militarily mostly successful, drained the Ming treasury and depleted Ming fighting power. But in the end, the most significant of the Ming's many wars wouldn't be against Japanese pirates, or Burmese, or Mongols, or even Toyotomi Hideyoshi's samurai hordes, but rather against a Jurchen chief named Nurhachi. The semi-nomadic Jurchen were scattered across northeastern Asia, from the Korean border across Manchuria into present-day Russia and Mongolia, organized into rival tribal units. Employing a combination of diplomacy, marriage alliances, and conquest to unite the typically divided Jurchen into one people, Nurhachi's rise was initially supported by the Ming, to whom he sent tribute until 1609. By the 1590s, Nurhachi was dominant among the Jurchen, and by 1619 he had absorbed almost all of them into his unique social, economic, and military structure. the Eight Banners system. All Yurkin households were assigned a division, each categorized by banner color, thereby superseding the old tribal structure. Specialized hereditary bannermen filled elite military roles within the Yurchin army, all organized by banner. Everything from land distribution and social welfare to taxation operated within the banner system, too. To further unify his people, Nurhaci ordered the creation of a new written script for the Yurchin language based on Mongol script, itself derived from the old Uyghur alphabet. By 1616, Nurhaci was confident enough in his position to declare himself Khan of the Great Jin, thereby historically connecting his new regime with that of the old Jin dynasty of the 12th and 13th centuries, which had also been Yurchin. Nurhaci's declaration signified a break with Ming China. Henceforth, the Great Jin would claim to be China's political equal. Indeed, Nurhaci now began to expand south at China's expense. How did Japan become politically unified around the turn of 17th century? Francis Xavier arrived in Japan in 1549, landing at Kagoshima and later traveling to Hirado and Yamaguchi. The Jesuit worked diligently to learn the Japanese language and adapt to Japanese culture. He found most success preaching among southern Japan's lower classes, though several daimyo ultimately supported his mission too. It helped his cause that for the enterprising Japanese, embracing the gospel message also meant potential trade with the Portuguese. At Kagoshima, the daimyo Shimazu Takahisa of Satsuma greeted the foreign arrival warmly, allowing him to preach until pressure from the local Buddhist establishment limited his freedom there. Still, Xavier baptized his first Japanese converts at Kagoshima, establishing a Christian community in the area. The powerful Uchi Yoshitaka, daimyo of Yamaguchi, listened to Xavier and subsequently granted him permission to preach, too. A thriving Christian community soon existed in Yamaguchi. The daimyo of Bungo, Otomo Yoshishige, likewise received Xavier with kindness, inviting the Jesuit into his home, exchanging gifts, and allowing him to freely preach within his domains. Soon, a Christian community existed here too. By the time Francis Xavier left Japan in 1551, the Jesuit may have baptized as many as 1,000 people or more. Little could he have known that, within just a few decades, the number of Japanese Christians would balloon into the hundreds of thousands. Meanwhile, on China's southern coast and unnoticed by the vast majority of Chinese, the Portuguese finally managed to secure a legal base for trade on the Macau Peninsula. The Ming's shift in attitude vis-a-vis the Portuguese was largely the result of Portuguese help fighting pirates in the 1540s and 1550s. It was in this historical context that, following his successful missionary work in Japan, Francis Xavier arrived at Shangchuan Island, some 50 miles from Macau, where Portuguese traders operated a primitive, and at the time still illegal, outpost. For years, Xavier had insisted on the importance of missionary work in China, the crucial center of influence in this world region. The Jesuits' goal? To penetrate the Chinese mainland and establish a foothold for the spread of Christianity there. Unfortunately for the hardy Catholic, the Chinese man he had bribed to smuggle him to the mainland took his money but never returned to fulfill his end of the bargain. Stranded in a temporary hut on Shangchuan, Xavier came down with a high fever and died in December 1552. He never set foot on mainland China. 5 years later, and grateful for the naval assistance of the Portuguese, Ming authorities finally granted them permission to establish a permanent settlement at Macau for an annual fee of 500 taels of silver. From here, the Portuguese hoped to benefit as intermediaries in the lucrative trade between Japan and China. Back in Japan, the country entered what historians call the Momoyama period, 1573 to 1603, characterized by the steady political unification of the islands for the first time in history. This unification was primarily carried out by three great military leaders, Oda Nobunaga, Toyotomi Hideyoshi, and Tokugawa Ieyasu. By the quarter-century-long Momoyama period's end, Japan had been forged by blood, iron, and gunpowder into a single feudal state. A daimyo from central Japan, Oda Nobunaga was both a military genius and arguably one of history's most brutal conquerors. Over the course of his bloody career, he would kill countless people, and often in horrific ways, to achieve his political ends. To crush the warrior monks of the old pre-Zen Tendai tradition, in 1571 he ordered the complete destruction by fire of their entire temple complex, surrounding the mountain upon which it sat, and slaughtering all of its inhabitants as they attempted to flee, whether monks, women, or children. 3 years after the burning of Mount Hiei, his forces surrounded the settlements of another religious sect and set it ablaze, killing some 20,000 people in a day. Oda Nobunaga ordered the decapitation of vast numbers of his enemies, publicly displaying their severed heads as a sign of his power over life and death. His own family members were not spared his murderous wrath, underscored by his personal motto, "Rule the empire by force." A key to Oda Nobunaga's military success, new technology, specifically the use of the Portuguese musket, which he acquired both via trade with Portuguese merchants and the rapidly expanding domestic production of these cutting-edge weapons. Nobunaga's rapid integration of musketeers into his army typically gave his forces a critical advantage in battle, allowing him to begin the process of swallowing up the domains of rival daimyo. Critically, one of his first conquests had been the area around the imperial capital of Kyoto, where the emperor lived, of course, granting Oda Nobunaga imperial protector status and greatly boosting his legitimacy among his men and throughout the country. Once he had conquered a large swathe of Japan, a little less than half of the total subjugated territory strategically distributed to his loyal vassals, he set about consolidating his power by squelching the power of the rival Buddhist establishment. Interestingly, Oda Nobunaga actively patronized southern Japan's burgeoning Christian community as a counterweight to the Buddhists. The great unifier built roads, conducted a thorough land survey, rid his vast domain of internal trade barriers, and critically, confiscated all of the peasants' weaponry. Then, in 1582, one of Oda Nobunaga's own officers killed him. In the wake of Oda Nobunaga's death, a succession struggle ensued, in the end won by the militarily gifted Toyotomi Hideyoshi. Of peasant stock, Hideyoshi had risen rapidly through the ranks of Oda Nobunaga's forces to become a trusted general. Hideyoshi now continued Nobunaga's conquering spree, adding new domains and dividing much of it into fiefs as a reward to loyal vassals, just as Nobunaga had done. Hideyoshi took full advantage of the system, awarding potentially troublesome daimyo territory far away from their natural power bases. Then, while they were away, forcing them to leave selected family members behind under Hideyoshi's personal protection, that is, as hostages. The wily and clever Toyotomi Hideyoshi, with his winning personality, could be more diplomatic than his predecessor, but he had no qualms about shedding blood either. Indeed, as time passed, Hideyoshi grew ever more tyrannical, paranoid, and brutal. To ensure succession by his young son Hideyori, Hideyoshi forced his nephew Hidetsugu to commit ritual suicide, then ordered the execution of Hidetsugu's entire family, including his wives, concubines, and children. One of Hidetsugu's concubines, a 15-year-old girl of the Mogami clan, had only just arrived. Indeed, she hadn't even met Hidetsugu yet. She was killed anyway. His two invasions of Korea saw him order the systematic killing of civilians, including women and children. He also ordered his generals to cut off the noses of the slain, then salt them and ship them back to Japan, in order to keep a tally of kills for potential future rewards. In 1597, Hideyoshi ordered the crucifixion of 26 Christians, including several foreign Franciscan missionaries and at least one child, to discourage foreign interference in Japan. In the meantime, Hideyoshi continued Nobunaga's weapons confiscation program, making it illegal for peasants to own swords, the latter now reserved only for samurai. By the time Toyotomi Hideyoshi had completed his various campaigns, he had conquered, or at least nominally controlled, virtually all of Japan south of Hokkaido, with limited influence on the native Ainu population of that northernmost Japanese island. After Hideyoshi's 1598 death, a power struggle ensued, eventually won after the Battle of Sekigahara by the daimyo Tokugawa Ieyasu. Ieyasu had been raised as a hostage of the Oda clan, where he learned military strategy and surely patience and resilience in the face of adversity, before allying with Nobunaga, then later submitting to Hideyoshi. While his lord was off fighting in Korea, Ieyasu stayed in Japan, consolidating his power at home and setting the stage for his bid for supremacy after Hideyoshi's death, culminating in Sekigahara. Perhaps among those fighting here was a teenager named Miyamoto Musashi, soon to be considered by some to be the greatest swordsman who ever lived. Let's head down to Akashi, Japan, to explore this further.
The castle behind me was designed in part by a guy named Miyamoto Musashi. Now, Miyamoto Musashi, he was kind of a Renaissance man. He was a master painter. He was a master calligrapher. He was a writer. He was a philosopher. He was a gardener. Obviously, he dabbled in architecture. But he was most famous for his mastery of the sword. In fact, he may have been the greatest swordsman who ever lived, not just in Japan, but in the world. Now, Musashi was born at an interesting time. He was born right at the tail end of a period of decentralization in Japan, a period of warlordism. Now, in the 1540s, a foreign group had shown up, the Portuguese, and using Portuguese guns, one brilliant but brutal general, his name was Oda Nobunaga, was able to take over half of Japan. By the time he died in 1582, he'd taken over half of Japan. 2 years later, Musashi was born. Oda Nobunaga was succeeded by another general, potentially more brilliant than Oda Nobunaga, and his name was Toyotomi Hideyoshi. Toyotomi Hideyoshi picked up right where Oda Nobunaga had left off after a brutal succession struggle, of course, and he went on to conquer virtually all of Japan. By the end, by the early 1590s, this is about the time that Musashi was around 10 years old, Toyotomi Hideyoshi controlled, nominally at least, virtually all of Japan. And as is so often the case, once a leader has unified a country, unified being a euphemism for subjugated and conquered brutally, the military might of that country is then projected outward. And in the case of Japan, that was true. Toyotomi Hideyoshi unified Japan and then immediately looked overseas to China and went on to try and conquer China through Korea. But that's a whole nother story. Throughout this time, the period of Toyotomi Hideyoshi's consolidation of power, Musashi was being trained in the art of the samurai. He grew up in a samurai family, and as was custom from a very young age, he was trained with the sword, he was trained with other weapons, and he became quite a master. In fact, by the time he was 13, he was already winning duels. His first duel was at the age of 13. He answered the challenge of a obviously older, more experienced, bigger, stronger guy. And in a few seconds, Musashi had the guy on the ground and basically beat him to death with a wooden stick. He died, you know, vomiting blood. So that's how the 13-year-old Musashi began to make a name for himself. Well, given Musashi's natural skill, talent, his abilities, that he's only going to develop further over the next few years, it's no surprise that we find him in 1600, still a teenager, on one of the great battlefields in Japanese history, there on the plains of Sekigahara, This is a great deciding battle, a succession struggle. Toyotomi Hideyoshi has died. He died a couple years previously. He'd handpicked a successor, his son. Unfortunately for Toyotomi Hideyoshi, when he died, his son was only 5 years old. So obviously there's going to be a struggle. Now, there we are, plains of Sekigahara. And we've got Toyotomi Hideyoshi's group, the supporters of his son, on one side. Musashi is among them. And then on the other side, you have the would-be successor, a brilliant general once again, and his name was Tokugawa Ieyasu. Now the plain or valley of Sekigahara lies on what used to be a major trunk road between Edo and Kyoto, the Nakasendo. And so it makes some sense that the big showdown between East and West in Japan, the great deciding battle in modern Japanese history, would take place here at Sekigahara. And so 160,000 soldiers show up, 80,000 for either side, here in this valley. Musashi probably among them. And if Musashi was among them, then he would be doing what they were doing that morning. It had rained very hard that night. They're all drying out their clothes probably in the early morning hours. And then there's a heavy mist in the air, and then around 8 in the morning that mist lifts. And shots are fired, and 6 hours of extremely bloody battle takes place. Tens of thousands are killed. We don't know if Musashi was for sure among them. In his own writings, he said that in his youth, he took part in half a dozen battles. He would have been about 16 if he took part in the Battle of Sekigahara. So it would make sense that he's a youth during this time, so this could have been the one, and certainly tradition states that he was here. But of course, he was on the losing side. He would escape. If he was here, obviously he would escape, and some of the others of the Army of the West escaped, but many, many did not. In fact, I'm standing on the grounds of it's a burial site of Western leaders and others whose heads were decapitated in the Japanese style and buried here. So their decapitated heads are buried right here on these grounds. Well, at the end of the day, Tokugawa Ieyasu was victorious, of course, and able to consolidate power over the next few years. 3 years after Sekigahara, he's given the title Shogun by the Emperor, and we enter a new age in Japanese history, 250 years of Tokugawa rule. By the 1610s, Tokugawa Ieyasu basically had control of Japan. But there was still one remnant of the Toyotomi clan that could possibly make trouble. And in fact, that remnant were sort of going to make their last stand here in Osaka, right here at this castle, at Osaka Castle. And who was among them? Who was fighting with them? None other than the great swordsman, Musashi. Well, they made their fight. It was a long struggle, 1614 to 1615, two different campaigns. But at the end of the day, Osaka Castle was in flames. Toyotomi Hideyori and his mother had committed suicide, and Tokugawa Ieyasu had taken the 8-year-old, the last member of the Toyotomi clan, and had beheaded him in Edo, and thus ended any chance of the Toyotomi clan ever making a comeback. And for Musashi, this was the last great battle that he would fight in. He may have been undefeated, and tremendously so, 60-plus undefeated duels one-on-one, but the two most important battles he would fight would both be defeats. Well, after Osaka, Musashi spent several years just wandering around Japan. And he'd wandered before. He'd gone on a sort of warrior's pilgrimage between Sekigahara and Osaka for years and years. So he's no stranger to wandering around Japan. He sets up a dojo here and there. He teaches students for a year or two or three, and then he'll move on to the next place. At one point, he finds himself in Edo, the capital of the new shogunate. And he might have been the teacher, the trainer of the shogun, had the shogun not already had several talented trainers that he was loyal to. So Musashi left Edo as well. Well, ultimately, he'll end up in Kumamoto, where he will help put down the great Christian rebellion there. He'll continue to duel, although usually now, he's got such a reputation at this point that the duels are usually at the instigation of his rivals, of his opponents, but he never lost. Well, Musashi, in his 50s, now keep in mind he'd spent most of his life as a ronin, in other words, as a masterless samurai. Well, now he's in his 50s. He's in Kumamoto, and he's finally made the retainer of the Lord of Kumamoto, who gives him a castle as residence, Chiba Castle. But unfortunately for Musashi, who finally gets what he was looking for all his life, he almost immediately gets sick. Now, this sickness could have been cancer. It could have been a nerve disorder. But whatever it was painful. Painful enough that it convinced him that he was dying. And so in very Buddhist fashion, actually, he went on sort of retreat to a cave. He retired to a cave. And it was in the cave that he wrote his most famous work, The Book of Five Rings. Each of the rings represented some distinct element of battle. But this was a book that was read by more than just, or would be read by more than just warriors and fighters. This was more than a fighting book. This was a philosophical treatise. And it's been, you know, its principles have been applied by all sorts of people ever since in Japan, not just warriors, not just soldiers. Well, just 2 or 3 months after handing off the finished Book of Five Rings to his best pupil, he did indeed pass away. Musashi died. Some of his remains were buried there in Kumamoto, and some of his remains were carried back here to the place of his birth, where they were buried next to his parents. Right here, actually, I'm standing next to one of the graves of Miyamoto Musashi. Now, maybe it's not a coincidence that Japan would produce its greatest swordsman, and perhaps the world's greatest swordsman, during one of its most turbulent and transformative periods.
Tokugawa Ieyasu could take the title of shogun since he was a descendant of Minamoto no Yoritomo, the founder of the Kamakura Bakufu. Clearly intending to found a dynasty of shoguns, Ieyasu abdicated after just 2 years to allow his 26-year-old son, Hidetada, to succeed him, though Ieyasu continued to act as the power behind the throne. Let's head down to the Shikoku countryside in Japan to explore this further.
The Portuguese, and then later the Spanish, who followed very quickly after them, brought two historically game-changing things to Japan. Number one, they brought Christianity. Number two, they brought guns, foreign-made guns. The Portuguese manner of making guns would be copied in Japan and used to great effect. Specifically, Oda Nobunaga would use foreign guns as a vital part of his very successful and brutal bid to establish himself as hegemon over the other great landowning lords in Japan, laying the foundation for what Toyotomi Hideyoshi and then Tokugawa Ieyasu would ultimately finish, that is, creating the first unified political state covering all of Japan in Japanese history. That had never been done before. Well, now it's being done with foreign guns. Meanwhile, hundreds of thousands of Japanese were converting to the foreigner's faith. It started in 1549 with the arrival of the famous world-traveling Jesuit, Francis Xavier. He arrived in Kagoshima in southern Japan, and things spread from there. Southern Japan was the base, though. Kyushu, southern Kyushu, was the great center of this first wave of Christianity. And the Jesuits dominated these missionary efforts for decades. Afterwards, it wasn't until the end of the century, the end of the 1500s, that you start to see some of the Spanish mendicant orders, the Franciscans, the Dominicans, they show up. Now, the Jesuits, they targeted in their conversion efforts, they targeted the samurai class, the upper class, okay? But the Spanish mendicant orders, the Franciscans, the Dominicans, they tended to target the lower classes. So a sort of missionary rivalry developed between the two, of course, rooted in some political things that were happening back home at the time. Be that as it may, the rivalry between the Portuguese Jesuits and the Spanish Franciscans and Dominicans and others was noticed. This rivalry was noticed by the Japanese. In fact, it really annoyed Japanese leaders at times, often with disastrous results for both the foreign missionaries as well as their Japanese converts. Well, eventually, the southern Japanese port of Nagasaki, which basically was a village before all this, will become Japan's most important international commercial depot. You know, trading with Spanish Manila, all that gold and silver coming from the Americas, trading with China, that's the big trade, the China-Japan trade, of course. All this international trade basically is controlled or at least facilitated by the Portuguese, these Portuguese Jesuits. And they're able to funnel all that money into building churches, building seminaries, and otherwise going about their now very well-funded missionary activities. And they wield very, you know, powerful influence over the local daimyo. The bulk of Nagasaki is converting to Christianity. I mean, this is important stuff. These are major steps for these Jesuits. Well, when this trade becomes super lucrative, of course, that's going to draw the attention of the powers that be. And, you know, there's some major powers establishing themselves in Japan at this time. We already mentioned Oda Nobunaga and Toyotomi Hideyoshi. And these guys are establishing a unitary government, one united, strong, centralized authority in Japan. And as all central authorities do, when you see the opportunity to make a lot of money, you want to take it. Well, Nagasaki has now become sort of a gem in terms of revenue. And Toyotomi Hideyoshi, in particular, is concerned about the Chinese silk trade. And he can look down at Nagasaki and he can see that the trade is basically dominated by a bunch of foreign priests. And he doesn't like that. And he wants that revenue. At one point, he becomes angry at some of the Spanish orders. He crucifies 26 Christians in Nagasaki. And then later, he comes on in and basically takes Nagasaki and all that trade revenue for himself. Now in the 16 teens, two other European players show up on the Japanese scene. And those two players are the Dutch and the English, both European Protestants. Now that's important because up to this point, the Japanese have been dealing with the Spanish and the Portuguese. Now they may have their rivalries, these Iberians, but they're both Catholic. They're both Roman Catholic. Well, here come these Northern European Protestants. And this reveals to the Japanese that Christianity is divided. Okay, this was not really known before. Christianity is divided. And you don't have to convert to Christianity to do business with the Dutch and the English, in particular the Dutch. The English aren't really going to stick around very long, but the Dutch will. And they'll do business with you whether or not you're a Christian. In fact, the Dutch will prove very willing to fight other Christians or trample on Christian symbols or whatever they have to do business in Japan, they'll do it. This is really important information, particularly when Tokugawa Ieyasu, who is consolidating his own power in Japan, gets wind of an alleged Iberian plot to take over Japan. And so he promptly bans Christianity. And tons of Christian executions follow, the destruction of Christian churches. It's very difficult and, you know, deadly to be a Christian in Japan for years afterwards. And the Portuguese and the Spanish, they've lost their spot as, you know, the conduit through which the Japanese islands do international trade. In the 1630s, after a major allegedly Christian revolt in southern Japan, the Tokugawa shogunate, which had relatively recently been established, was still very suspicious of its power, decided to institute what would ultimately become a 250-year policy of strict isolationism. This was real isolationism. Today, people and politicians talk about isolationism, put it down and whatnot. This was isolationism, okay? Basically, according to the Tokugawa shogunate's edict, no foreigners were allowed in Japan. On pain of death, some tried and they got their heads cut off. So, you know, they learned their lesson, I guess. This was real isolationism. No foreigners allowed. And it wasn't just foreigners. The Japanese themselves were not allowed to leave Japan. To those Japanese whose businesses or livelihood or interests lay outside of Japan, I mean, Japan, the Japanese islands basically became a big prison to these people. Not allowed to leave. On pain of death. Can't leave Japan on pain of death. Before this, there were huge overseas and very vibrant Japanese communities in East Asia and Southeast Asia. Those guys weren't even allowed to come back home. They were done. And over the next few generations, they're going to assimilate into, you know, their local societies and basically disappear. So this was huge. This would have a major effect on Japanese history, and as it turns out, on world history as well. So 250 years of isolationism. The only Europeans still allowed to do business with the Japanese were the Dutch, who'd shown themselves, as I mentioned before, very willing even to fight against other Christians in order to do business in Japan. But even they were restricted. It's only a few ships a year. They had to trade through this little man-made island called Daejima in Nagasaki Harbor, and that's it. There were a few Chinese in there too, so the Dutch and the Chinese just through Nagasaki Harbor and only a few ships a year, and that's it. Henceforth, all knowledge of the West, including Western science, would come through the Dutch and in the Dutch language. Thus, the Europeans Unwittingly, of course, but still, the Europeans had contributed to the closing off of Japan for 250 years. First, through their guns, which helped create the regime that was able to do this and enforce this, and second, through their religion, at least through the political meddling that was associated with the establishment of their religion. See, before this, before the Tokugawa period, the Japanese were a very maritime people. They were very active on the seas. You don't think of the Japanese that way before the 20th century, but they were. You know, when the Portuguese rounded Southeast Asia, approaching the East Asian seas, what they found were the Japanese were very prevalent on the ocean. In fact, dominant on the ocean, more than the Chinese. It was the Japanese, some scholars speculate, that would have been first to conquer and colonize the Philippines. It was the Japanese, maybe, that would have taken over and colonized Australia, if not for the combination of the European presence and strictly enforced isolationism of Tokugawa rule. See, these are things that we don't think of, but this is potentially game-changing stuff. Japanese were very, very active maritime people, very, very energetic, very adventurous maritime people. Then throw in 250 years of basically a virtual wall being erected around Japan by the Tokugawa shogunate, and that's culture changing. That'll change a culture. That's many generations of change. Even the size of the Japanese boat was strictly regulated. It couldn't be, you know, large seagoing vessels. They could only be small. I mean, this is a true culture shift, and it allowed others to fill the void that the Japanese left behind.
Unwittingly, it seemed, the Portuguese had facilitated the political and military unification of Japan for the first time, with world-changing consequences. In sum, in 1545, Francis Xavier traveled from India to Malacca and then to the Moluccas, where he preached and baptized converts before returning to Malacca, there inspiring a small Portuguese force to decisively defeat an attacking Aixanese fleet in 1546. Meanwhile, Portugal expanded its Southeast Asian presence through strategic forts and trading posts to control trade routes to China and Japan. The Iberian Union of 1580 set Spain's enemies against Portugal, enabling the emerging Dutch and English East India companies to begin challenging and eroding the Portuguese monopoly by the early 17th century. Concurrently, on the Southeast mainland, Tabinchueti built the Tungu dynasty's empire by conquering Pegu, Prome, Pagan, and parts of Arakan, additionally initiating prolonged wars with Siam. But his decline into alcoholism led to his 1550 assassination, after which Bienong reunified and vastly expanded the realm, conquering Ava, the Shan states, Lan Na, Manipur, and even Ayutthaya. He thus created Southeast Asia's largest pre-modern empire before his 1581 death, though it rapidly fragmented afterward. Burmese tradition later hailed Bienong as the second of the country's great kings. Siam reasserted its independence under Narasuan in 1584. As for the Tungu dynasty, it later revived under Nyongyen Min and Anokpetlin. In China, the late 16th and early 17th centuries saw rampant corruption, factional strife, fiscal strain due to massive silver inflows, tax breaks on the gentry, and near constant war. As to the latter, the Ming battled Japanese pirates, Mongols, rebellious hill peoples in the southwest, Tungu Burma, the Japanese, in the costly Imjin War, and the rising Nurhaci, who unified the Yurchin via the Eight Banners system. In Japan, and thanks in large part to the introduction of Portuguese muskets, the late 16th century saw the political unification via blood, iron, and gunpowder of the main archipelago south of Hokkaido, for the first time in history, the work especially of three men, Oda Nobunaga, Toyotomi Hideyoshi, and Tokugawa Ieyasu.